I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. It is a billion-dollar-a-year industry that spans the globe. Not software or steel or automobiles. I'm talking about the trade in human hair. And anthropologist Emma Tarlow knows all about it. Her new book is called Entanglement: The Secret Lives of Human Hair. She started by telling me about a third-generation hair trader in India named Kishore Kumar.
He'd actually made his wedding outfit out of human hair, which was Indian hair, bleached and dyed blonde and then decorated with a little red sequins. He also had this idea that he was going to start manufacturing hair for all sorts of different uses, such as fertilizer, for food, for skin products, and cloth. And he was from three generations of hair traders who'd actually started off trading in yak hair, mongoose, and bird feathers back in 1919.
Yeah, did you actually see the wedding outfit that Mr. Kumar made?
I did, yes. He proudly showed me his wedding outfit and a photograph of him sitting in a gold throne wearing it. What is interesting is that human hair has been used for all sorts of uses, particularly in the 1970s and 80s. It was being exported in bulk to places like Korea and Japan for use as interlining in men's suits. And it was supposed to be particularly good for this because it was a little bit stretchy and, on the other hand, it didn't crease. I think this is really a completely sort of unknown element.
It's kind of wild how many people from different corners of the world are involved in some aspect of the hair trade. You travel to Myanmar, and the backstory to this, your interpreter's mother won a lottery and the prize was to become a nun for 9 days. What did that involve?
In Burma, many people hope to pass some of their time in a Buddhist convent or monastery. And in her case, this was a woman who'd never had a haircut in her life. So her hair was sort of down below her hips. Her hair was completely shaved off, and she considered it a great honor.
Tonsure, or head shaving, it's been a ritual of purification for several different religions for centuries, right?
Yes, and it's still very much practiced in South India, in the Hindu temples, where a number of people make vows to the Hindu gods that if something good happens, like a good marriage arrangement or a business thing takes off or someone recovers from an illness, then the whole family will go to the temple as a pilgrimage and they'll all have their heads shaved and then go to worship.
Hair can fetch pretty high prices. What happens to that hair in those tonsure halls?
Yes, well, the hair in the tonsure halls is very carefully looked after. If people have long hair, then it's actually tied up into two bunches before it's shaved off so that the hair is actually kept all in order and it's immediately put in these safes, locked safes. And then it's all transported up to the sorting workshops where it's sorted into very precise lengths. And then about three times a year, it's auctioned off by e-auction to prevent hair cartels and fixing of prices.
Hair cartels?
Yeah. Well, there was a fixing of prices between hair companies. So now it's done by e-auction, so people can't see what other bidders are bidding.
So you also traveled to Qingdao in eastern China, where you met the owner of a company that specializes in wigs and toupees. This man's name is Raymond Tse. He built a factory that makes hair pieces. It now employs 8,000 workers. Describe this factory for us.
Yes. Well, Raymond Chi, in fact, has several factories, so they're not all 8,000 workers in the same one. One of the factories that I went round was particularly interesting. It was specialized in sort of custom-made hair pieces, mainly for people with hair loss in America and Europe and all over the world. The factory receives 500 templates a day, and these are individual head templates that have been measured from people's heads, either using sort of cling film, which is a type of plastic, or something called dermalite, which is a more sort of high-tech material. Along with these templates, they receive incredibly precise details of the exact color, texture, hair density, and shading required for a particular person's hairpiece. And then all these details are translated into Mandarin, and then they're dispersed out around the factory. Raymond Chi claimed that there were something like 120 stages to making a hairpiece. It's a very precise and complex and intricate thing.
How ethically managed are most of these businesses?
Some are quite well managed and others are very clearly badly managed. The very bottom end of the industry, you've got the recuperation of comb waste, which is hair that's fallen from people's heads during brushing and combing and washing. And that is collected up door to door by peddlers. So throughout Asia, you've got peddlers going door to door, collecting really what are globs of hair balls. And these all have to be untangled. And the untangling of this hair takes place in workshops and in people's homes. homes in very poor places where the labour is cheapest, so in parts of Bangladesh, parts of India, and increasingly in Myanmar. So when I was visiting a village in Myanmar, I could see people sorting out these hairballs just with a needle in their village homes. And I met an old lady, she was 83, and she said, "I can't see much, but I make up for it with patience."
Wow.
And when I asked her where this hair was from or where it was going or what it would be used for, she had absolutely no idea. And this was similarly the case with other people there. And when I said to her, "What did you think it was for?" she just said, "Money." And everybody burst out laughing.
Really, though, I mean, how prevalent is that kind of situation? Because what can you possibly make taking old dead hair out of a comb?
Because the hair is very long, most people in Myanmar still would never cut their hair. So if you untangle it, sort it, hackle it, resort it, rehackle it, you can get it into absolutely perfect lengths, which can be really quite considerable. And that hair, you know, it looks like the tails of horses kind of thing, beautifully bound. And that hair is all bound up and then it's sent on to the factories in China. And although it's recycled sort of waste hair in some sense, it is used very extensively in the wig industry. What they'll do is they'll drop it into a sort of chemical bath which strips it of its cuticle and so it doesn't tangle so much. And then it's used for wigs and hair extensions.
Wow. So one more character from your book, a man named Benjamin Sherian.
Yes.
He's in India. He's trying to make the hair trade more respectable and raise the standards. How's he doing that?
He'd started off in the late 1970s trading in waste hair for suit interlinings. But nowadays, he specializes particularly in temple hair and preparing it for the sort of top end of the market. And yes, he was very keen to improve standards. So he himself had very good labor rights in his factories. He was recycling the water. He'd got all sorts of certification proving that his factory met international standards of trade. But that is quite rare.
So one final use of human hair that will surprise everybody. This is not for the squeamish. Mm-hmm. Human hair can be made into an additive that is a flour enhancer and sometimes is found in pizza, dough, and bagels. Really?
Well, human hair is basically very rich in L-cysteine, which is a type of amino acid, which is particularly good as a flavor enhancer and also for giving elasticity to foods. So it was commonly used in bagels and pizza base, and probably still is to some extent because it's very difficult to trace where L-cysteine comes from. There are certainly factories in China that continue to produce L-cysteine, which they sell into the food industry. But whether the bagel that you ate for breakfast actually contains that, I don't know.
Anthropologist Emma Tarlow, her latest book is called Entanglement, The Secret Lives of Human Hair. Good to speak with you. Thank you.
Thank you.
This is The World.